Well, it's Richard Mackey with Graham Zilm and Marvin Storo. It's 15th of August 2012, and we're at Marvin's house. So as I was saying before the interview, I hope we could possibly have two interviews, one later on with Doug Harris present, one now, which starts with your early life and goes up into your career. So can you mention where something about your family or background?
My family or background? My father was born in England, in Northern England. My mother's family is from England. They were here about two generations before she was born. My father was born in Penrith, England, which is just south of the Scottish border.
Penrith.
Penrith. Penrith, yes, a small community there. And they arrived in Vancouver. My mother and father met when they were in their 20s, got married. I was born in 1934, and I don't know whether you're interested in this, but my father took me to Coquitlam one day, and I drank some unpasteurized milk, and I ended up in the hospital for 3 years. Mm. I was the first person x-rayed at the Children's Hospital in Vancouver. Mm. That would be about 1939, when the hospital was on 59th Avenue. So I had three major spinal surgeries there, and I spent 3 years there.
What did you get from
TB? TB from the unpasteurized milk. It's just a kind of a freaky bad piece of luck. But that was the beginning of my life. Then I went to Catholic schools when I was young. One in the East End of Vancouver, Spokane and Fender Street, Our Lady of Sorrows, it's called. And then my father died when I was 14. He was 41, very suddenly. He was actually a very brilliant man. He truly was.
What did he do?
He ran his own business that he started 2 years before he died. It was an electrical business involving the fishing industry to a large extent. He brought the first echo sounders into Canada. But he was an inventor as well. He invented various electrical devices and so on. And he was considered to be one of Vancouver's finest athletes in a lot of different sports, and was one of the world's leading trap and skeet shooters. It must be doubles, if you know it. Fire off two clay pigeons at once. Very quick reactions. So anyway, he left my mother at 37 with me and my two sisters, who were at that time 3 and about 7. So we managed. It wasn't easy, but we struggled through. I went to high school at Vancouver College so that I could be taught by men, because I didn't have a father. My mother found it better be taught by men, so I went there. Across the city every day, back and forth.
And this was up here at the Point Grey area?
Yeah, no, it's in at around 41st and Granville, Vancouver College. It's a Christian Brothers school. And from there, I left high school, of course, eventually, and I didn't know what to do, so I became an electroencephalogram technician. I learned how to do that at St. Paul's Hospital under Dr. W.C. Gibson. He was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant man, and was Pat LaGuerre's mentor. Mm-hmm. You know who Pat LaGuerre is?
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gibson was his mentor.
Was he the Gibson who ended up at in Victoria?
Yes.
As the Chancellor, I think, of UVic.
He might have been, yes. Mm-hmm. I think he probably was. He
lived to a great age.
He did, well over 90. He was just a superb man. Well, when I was working there, he encouraged me to go to university and become a doctor, in fact, a brain surgeon. So I started off in university with that thought in mind, and I don't know why, but I changed my mind to law and entered the UBC Law School in 1959, and luckily, I got into the class of all these other fine men and women that you are aware of.
Did you do your undergraduate work at?
Partly at UBC and partly at Seattle University in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I went there because I could work and pay my way through school as I went to school. Mm-hmm. So I had a job there running a computer, as it then was, in a bank. Mm-hmm. I worked about up to 60 hours a week on my job plus the school, so it was a pretty busy time. But then I went to UBC and finished off. I didn't get an arts degree. I'm about two courses short. I wanted to get into law school quicker. So. And at that time, people were getting in after just 2 years of arts, previously. And now it's harder to get into law school, but easier to get out. Then it was easy to get in, not easy to get out. We started our law class, I think, you can confirm this, my recollection is the number 135. Mm-hmm. We ended up with 75 graduates. So you can see that it wasn't easy to pass necessarily. We failed a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Some of them I thought shouldn't have failed, frankly. Mm-hmm. They would have been good lawyers that couldn't get a good mark in contracts or something.
So they just drew the line of if you were below a certain line, you were out?
55% or something, you're out. And it was quite brutal. And I can think of two or three, I won't mention their names, that didn't pass that I thought would have been pretty good lawyers and were very good men, very good people. We only had three women in our class. Mm-hmm. Now that's a different phenomenon today. Mm-hmm.
Did you keep in touch with any of those who didn't quite make it?
I kept in touch a little bit with one that didn't, but he lived in Calgary. Mm-hmm. And he was the best friend of Bill O'Leary of our class. Mm-hmm. You should make a note of his name. He was our gold medalist 3 years in a row. Mm-hmm. And was, I'm told, we didn't see each other's marks, but I think he was about 5% ahead of the student that came second. Now that's a tremendous difference. It could be 1/10 of 1%, but Bill was. And he was a wonderful fellow. He had been a professional hockey player in England. He's from Calgary, but he went to play hockey in England. Came back.
He's not in here, is he?
I don't know.
I'll
tell you the truth. I hope he is.
Well,
you'll find that in that book.
Yes, he is.
Our class put together that some of them are very modest. They didn't describe really what they could have about themselves. Others aren't so modest. Bill was just a wonderful guy. Mm. He went back to Calgary, got married, met a lady at UBC. They got married. They have three children now. And Bill became a judge of the Alberta Court of Appeal. And I'm sure a very good judge. He's retired now.
Mm. Does he ever come to Vancouver? Could we ever grab him when he's here?
He could. I don't know when, but... they still have friends here, and he was at our reunion. I don't know if you met him, but he was there.
He must have been there, yeah.
Next year, now this is probably too late for you guys, but I'm chairing a gala dinner for Chief Justice Lance Finch's retirement. June 6th next year. And I would be surprised if Bill O'Leary wasn't at that, and a lot of Lance's other classmates. I'm hoping to get 600 or 700 people at it.
So, it'd be a good opportunity to snag them and
talk to them. Oh, absolutely. No, if I can help you, let me know, because they're really very, very fine people. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised. Another man from Calgary in our class was Doug Mitchell.
I remember him.
Remember Doug? Yeah.
There's the rink up at UBC, and he was...
Serena's named after Doug.
And he's the Olympic, the Calgary Olympics organizer, I think.
I don't think he was the organizer. No? He was probably involved, though. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Lois, is very involved in Calgary. Mm-hmm. Lois is getting an Order of Canada this year. Mm-hmm. I think Doug already has one. And UBC gives out what's called the Lifetime Achievement Award. That's for the whole university. Mm-hmm. And I think they changed that just... this past year, if they're not calling it, they've combined two awards, Lifetime Achievement and another one, and got rid of the name Lifetime Achievement, but Doug's going to get the equivalent of that award this year, and only about 20 people in the history of the school have gotten that award. And if I may say so, two of the others are Frank Iacobucci and me. I'm sorry, I hate talking about myself, but if you want to know.
That's the point.
If you want to know the facts, so to speak, I have to say these things.
But, yep.
Doug's going to get it this year, and I'm going to nominate Chief Justice Finch for the UBC Law School Lifetime Achievement Award. And I hope he gets it. He's very deserving of it. He's a terrific man and a very fine Chief Justice.
How many of the graduates of that 62 class became judges? Do you know?
I'd have to really concentrate, but I think roughly 12. 12 out of 75 is a very high percentage, extremely high. Another graduate of our class, Martin Taylor, who's an outstanding fellow, became a judge of our Court of Appeal. Bob Hunter became a judge of the Supreme Court of BC. Von Hembroff became a judge of the Alberta Queen's Bench Division, which is the equivalent of our Supreme Court. And then we had about five or six that became members of the provincial court.
Mm-hmm.
That's the court that does a lot of the criminal work at the first level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've had five or six like that. One of them, Ken Doolin, became what's called the master, which is kind of a Supreme Court judge in BC. Mm-hmm. He does what's called motions rather than trials.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a master, mm-hmm. fine fellow. Ken Benson, one of our classmates, became vice president of the CPR. David Anderson became a cabinet minister in Ottawa, has got an Order of Canada, and Dave was an Olympic rower. He's got an Olympic rowing medal. Mm-hmm. Got that while at law school. Another one of our graduates, Bill Britton, while at law school, played football for the BC Lions, and then graduated and went to Calgary and played for Calgary and was a good player. He was a good player. And then became the chairman of Bennett Jones, the largest law firm in Alberta at the time. Now, there have been mergers since, but that's a very, very prominent law firm, Bennett Jones. Doug Mitchell played football while at UBC as well. He was a very good player. We had another player that didn't graduate named Bruce Claridge. He was very, very well-known BC Lions football player, but he chose not to go on and complete.
What was the curriculum? Was there a set, a core curriculum at that time?
Contracts, torts, constitutional law, criminal law. We had a lot of guest lecturers from downtown Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, do they still do that, Graham?
I don't recall getting a lot of guest lectures, but I did take a course this past term that was taught by two practitioners. So it's advanced criminal law taught by a couple of practitioners.
Oh, okay. Now we had some of the most prominent downtown lawyers come out, take courses or parts of courses to teach for us, and Angela Branca was one, Douglas McKay Brown, Bert Schmidt, Tommy Ellis, Tommy Ellis was another downtown lawyer that came to speak to us and give us courses.
What were they, how did that work? Didn't they have faculty who were experts, or did they?
Not enough faculty, I guess.
Yeah.
We had a lot of downtown people came out to speak to us, like even give us courses, you know, or parts of courses, I guess I could say. So it was nice to meet them, you know. It was These are the names I gave you were at the time sort of the creme de la creme of the litigation bar.
Were they guest lectures? Were they were just one lecture, or did they give?
Oh no, several. Hmm? Several, yeah, and they did it year after year.
So you could get a sense of what they were like as
yeah,
as lawyers and as people.
Yeah, they were good. I can tell you a story if you want.
Sure. Yes.
When we were called to the bar in Articley, we didn't have what's called PLTC now. We didn't have formal courses. We'd go to a law office and a lawyer would spend a half an hour with us in wills and trusts or something. We'd go home. No exams until the end, when you had an oral exam. So my oral exam was by John Ferris. Ferris and Company, his father founded it, not him. His father was a senator. And Angelo Branca, who at the time was probably the best-known lawyer in Vancouver, I think. They were two benchers in the Law Society. And John Ferris asked me no questions. Angelo had a list of 283 questions to ask me. I don't know whether I'd rather you didn't print this, but I'll tell you this story just to show you there's a difference between the east side of Vancouver and the west side. And so Angelo kept asking me these questions after questions, and he didn't know the answers sometimes either, and thought my answer was wrong and was right. Anyway, that was Angelo. He was quite a fellow. And finally he asked me, what was Section 46 of the county court rules? Well, no one cares. Honestly, it doesn't matter what it is. So I said, Angelo, you tell me what Section 47 is, I'll tell you what 46 is, and any more of these effing questions and I'm leaving. So he asked me three or four more and I just left. And I thought, the hell with it, I'm not going to be a lawyer. I failed for sure. And I got outside, and like I was brought up in the East End, like you guys, where you guys live. One of my dear friends of my class, Michael Dumoulin, was the son of Len Dumoulin. They lived just around the corner up here on the west side. And his father was the man that founded Russell Dumoulin, the big law firm. So I said, Mike, well, good to know you, buddy, but I ain't going to be no lawyer here because I can't answer these questions of Angelo's, 283 questions. I said, Mike, what did they ask you? He said, well, they asked me if I was Len's son, and I said yes, and they said, that's fine, you can go. What a beginning. Anyway, Angelo was just putting me on. He knew me, you see. We were in the same church. So I found out later it was a kind of a joke. But it wasn't a joke to me, if you can imagine, after 7 or 8 years in school and to have to suffer through that. Anyway.
So you said this was the difference between the east and west.
And the west, so you see, and Angelo
Ferris said had no questions.
Didn't ask any questions. Ferris actually lived at around Angus and Granville Street in my aunt's house. His family bought my aunt's house. I didn't know her because she was rich and we weren't. But he lived in the what's called the Benchley Estate House. He didn't ask any questions. Do you know anything about Ferris?
We've heard his name from a few people, but we don't know much.
Turn that on.
Names like Branca and Rankin. It would be nice to know a bit, some of your recollections of them.
Yeah, well, Angelo Branca was, first of all, when he was young, he was a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was the Canadian welterweight champion. His daughter, Dorothy Holmes is her name. She became a provincial court judge. Do you know the name Tommy Braidwood?
Braidwood, yes.
The Braidwood Inquiry. Tommy was one of Angelo's proteges. And worked with Angelo very closely for quite a while. He was a very aggressive cross-examiner in criminal cases. He never went to law school, never went to university, I think. He got his right to practice law by articling, clerking, for, I don't know, 5 years or whatever it was, and became one of Canada's most outstanding lawyers. And then he ended up being on our Court of Appeal until he retired. So he was quite a well-known figure in Vancouver for a long time. Quite well-known. Harry Rankin, was a very free-spirited man who was a communist, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of that. Yep. He fought for Canada in the war. He was a soldier. And claimed to be a communist at one point in his life. So that kind of hung over his head for a long time. Mm. And there was a time when if you were a communist, you couldn't become a member of the bar. But I think that he transcended that eventually. Harry became an alderman in Vancouver. And Harry, in my opinion, although he was very brusque and aggressive, was one of the more generous people in our profession. Did an awful lot for impecunious people, represented them, his whole firm did. And in my opinion, Harry Rankin was a very good man. But others will say he was very controversial. I got to know him quite well, and he was very kind, very thoughtful, and wanted to equalize the system so that the rich got the same representation as the poor, more or less. And did a lot to stimulate the notion of legal aid in BC. Legal aid is not the most it's not the oldest. What did I last say there, Kent?
Legal aid.
Oh, legal aid, yes. Yeah. It wasn't always the case that there was legal aid. Legal aid kind of started by a man named Ossie Gill, Hart, who used to organize it through his own apartment without charge, so he'd persuade somebody to represent somebody in a serious case.
This was in Vancouver?
Yeah, without fee. No fee. And then legal aid started to pay $30 a day for less serious cases and $50 a day for serious cases, and no fees for preparation. That's all you got. You could prepare for 400 hours and not get paid for it. So that was the beginning of it. And then we started to become more organized on legal aid in the province. And interest from lawyers' trust accounts went to the foundation to pay for help pay for legal aid. Now, at that time, let me just think now what I'm talking about. When I was a bencher in the 1980s, the banks were paying interest on lawyers' trust accounts based on the monthly minimum balances. So you could have $50 million in there for 29 days and $50 for one day, and you got the interest on the $50. It was ridiculous. I happened to meet the president for BC of the Bank of Commerce, and I said, this is just wrong. You can't continue this way. I've been this way for years. And so I persuaded him to pay interest on the monthly average balance, which was infinitely greater than the monthly minimum. And all other banks followed because they thought they'd all the lawyers would deposit the money in the Bank of Commerce if they didn't do the same thing, you see. So that helped to raise a lot of money for legal aid, but there's still not enough. It's a very, very important part of our legal system, in my opinion. We can't have people who are poor not defending themselves as well as the rich, because the innocent poor are going to be convicted a lot more than the innocent rich that way. And I remember prosecuting unrepresented people. I couldn't believe what a mismatch was going on. There were occasions when I said to the accused, look, don't take the witness stand. There's no evidence against you. He didn't have a lawyer, and had he had a lawyer, it would be a slam dunk. You're not going to the witness stand because you'll be cross-examined to admit that you were there in the time of the crime. But I saw people do that, and I remember one guy, he wouldn't not take the stand, so I cross-examined him. Sure enough, he was there at the crime, and he got about 8 years in jail. But not he was guilty, but that's not the point. The point is the system. You've got to make the system even. There was a kidnapping case in Vancouver of the daughter of a very, very respected and well-known Vancouver person, and they caught the alleged kidnapper. He made a 5-page confession. They got the $50,000 ransom out of his car, and he went to court. I told the prosecutors, he dropped these three charges, will plead guilty to one. He's going to get 20 years in jail, probably. No, it's four charges or none. They're two girls kidnapped. So I said, okay, let's have a trial. We went to trial. The prosecutor forgot to identify the accused as the maker of the confession. He was acquitted. Now, it doesn't mean he wasn't guilty, but if he hadn't had a lawyer, he'd have been on that witness stand admitting that it was him that made the confession. And it would not have been fair relative to a represented person.
We were talking to someone who mentioned Mike Harcourt and relation to legal aid, to an early legal aid. We want to talk, we'd like to meet him.
You should talk to Mike. Yeah, he was on the TV yesterday. He and his brother just gave some money to some institution in Dunbar or something. He's a good guy. I like Mike.
So the legal aid thing, Ozzie Gill started it?
Well, as far as I know, he started it certainly in my little era, my time. And he did a good thing. His son, Stephen Gill, is a lawyer. Perhaps he's retired now, I'm not sure.
Who were the big lawyers, the main lawyers in Vancouver when you were...
courtroom lawyers or others?
Well, courtroom, seeing that that was your...
Michael Dumoulin's father, the one I mentioned, is from the West Side. Was certainly one. Len Dumoulin, a very fine man, too. Douglas McKay Brown, who was one of the partners of Len Dumoulin, Russell Dumoulin, is another. Art Harper of Harper Gray, it was called. Mr. Tysel, Harper Gray, the law firm, I think it's still called that. It used to be Tysel Harper Gray. Tysel was very prominent, became a Court of Appeal judge and a fine one. Leon and Tommy Ladner. Ladner, now it's now called Borden Ladner. They were very prominent, I think. And then Bullhauser and Tupper, Reggie Tupper, was very prominent. I think Reggie was the grandson of one of the founding fathers of Canada, Tupper. Walter Owen was another. Owen, there used to be a firm called Campney, Owen Murphy. They split off, Campney & Company, and now Owen & Company. Walter Owen was the president of the Canadian Bar. He was quite prominent.
Stephen, I guess, is the son? Stephen Owen?
No, I think nephew.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I know Stephen quite well. I like Stephen. I can't remember who his father was. The mayor of Vancouver is related, former mayor is related to Stephen Owen, too. The Owen family's moderately big. But I don't think Walter was Stephen's father. George Curtis at the law school was well known, quite a guy.
Was he the dean when you were?
He was the dean. Yeah, I got to like him. I met him about 15 years ago at some function out there, and he knew every case that I was working on that was in the court system on his way through the appeals or whatever at that time. Now, I don't know how the hell he did that. There's a lot of cases out there, and how he knew the ones I happened to be doing is ridiculous. I couldn't believe it. George Curtis, he died when he was over 90, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think well over 90.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he was an institution. Charles Bourne just died, too, and he was one of our professors. And Charles Bourne's daughter married one of our classmates, Alec Stewart, who just died, too, I'm afraid.
What was it like in the law school? Physically, what were the grounds like? Was it comfortable?
It was not too bad. Before we got there, they were in these concept huts, Mm-hmm. Do you ever see those? They're gone.
They're gone. They're gone. Before my time.
Everything's before your time. You're just a kid. there are these huts. We had some classes in these huts, but we also had the old law school. By that, I mean the one just before the new one. And it wasn't bad. We had a nice library and reasonably nice rooms, you know. Some of our professors were quite young. Very young, actually. Some of our professors were younger than the students. And I would suspect that the average age of students then was older than the average age now, but I'm not sure of that. We had people in our class that were over 40. And many that were sort of in their late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. So some of the professors, I mean, Professor Flackett, for example, I bet was about 26 when he taught us, and Ken Lissick, who became the dean, a very, very fine man, by the way, was probably less than 30. His daughter is one of my partners in Vancouver now, and a brilliant lawyer. David Huberman was another that was very young. He just got out of Harvard like the year before he taught us, I think.
Was Leon Getz there?
He wasn't there when we were there. He was after us. Yeah.
We've talked to him.
Oh, you've talked to Leon?
Yeah.
You can check that, but I don't think Leon was there when we were there. I'm not sure of that.
We can look that up. And so what was the articling process? Did you have to apply, or did they come and headhunt you, or how did
we,
that work?
I don't know. I was kind of, to be honest about it, kind of oblivious about the whole system. I was playing touch football and drinking beer too much to know what was going on. We used to go downtown and apply to get articles. And I went downtown 2 weeks before we graduated and knocked on a few doors and finally got articles at Cowan, Twining, and Collins, it was called at the time. It wasn't easy to get articles at that particular year. Every year is different, you know. But that was a tough year to get articles, and so I'm told. Now we have a lineup to get interviewed at our firm for articles, and other firms do too, of course. So it was different, but there are more graduates coming out now, but mind you, there are more firms too. So the year of articles at that time was, I don't think that there was that keen a determination to train article students. Certainly not formally by the Law Society, but even within the firms, people wouldn't sit down with you and say, now here's how you do a land conveyance, or here's how you incorporate a company or whatever. It was just sort of, oh, heck, we have to do this for a year, let's get it over with and get a job. So it's become far more educational now than when we were there. The students coming out of law school these days know a lot more about the law generally than we did. I'm pretty sure I'm safe to say that. There's maybe more to know too than we needed to know. I don't know. But
did you have electives?
Courses? Yes, we did. Yeah. And one of the my background before I got to law school in part was philosophy, and I was very disappointed when I got to law school, because that was the first year they canceled the legal philosophy course, and I don't know why to this day they did that. I think personally it's one of the most important courses.
What does that consist of?
Well, the philosophy of law. You know, what's the meaning of it? How did it start? What's the importance of it, and so on?
So it has a historical component.
Yeah,
does it?
It does. Yeah. Well, I didn't take the course because they didn't have it, but that's what it would be. Do you have it now?
I'm sure there are courses in legal philosophy, and they tend to give you, especially in the first year, an introduction to...
They do it.
It differs by school, and it differs every so often. They change the title of the course.
Yeah.
But they do try and give you sort of a broader understanding of law and context historically and ideologically.
Yeah.
And I think they do a pretty decent job.
Well, that's good. Everybody's got their own views, but in my opinion, that was something very lacking in my era, early on, certainly, as a lawyer. We didn't know why we were doing what we were doing, in effect. There was no depth. We needed more depth. I learned a lesson a long time ago. There was a lawyer in Canada named J.J. Robinette, QC. He was from Toronto. He was, in the minds of many, the lawyer in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very prominent and very, very good. He was a barrister,
mm-hmm.
in court all the time. And he told me once that the most important part of practicing law, 80% of what we do involves judgment. Judgment. Graham, when you get to be practicing, you don't have to know 25,000 contract cases. You have to know how to deal with people, how to make judgment calls on decisions, and where to take your clients to within your limitations as a lawyer. You're not owning the business if you're doing business law, but you've got to learn to exercise judgment, and especially perhaps in the court system. The best cross-examiners that I have seen in the court system are the ones that ask the fewest questions, not the ones that ask the most. They are usually the ones that aren't as good. It's getting to the essence of what we're doing that really matters, and that sometimes takes hard work and preparation, and it takes judgment. And you've got to, if you're in court, frequently you will see a witness that you have to cross-examine for the first time when the witness is on the witness stand. So you've got to say to yourself, no, what kind of a human being is this? How do you psychoanalyze him quickly so that he doesn't answer your questions the wrong way, or alternatively give you answers that you don't want? Because one of the rules in cross-examination and in trials is that if you ask a question of a witness called by the other side and you get the wrong answer, you can't say the answer is wrong. It's dangerous. Now, that's not an inflexible rule, but it's generally speaking the case, so you've got to be very careful, be prudent.
Anyway. How do you learn that?
I don't know. Some people understand human nature innately and others don't. I've often thought, that's a good question, I've often thought of how people learn that. And I've seen lawyers in the courtroom that don't have a clue about human nature. It's incredible sometimes what they do, not knowing that the audience is saying, what a bonehead, why are you doing that? And some of them are well known. You'd be surprised. You can't judge lawyers by the number of times they're in the newspaper. Sometimes that means they're the worst, not the best. Not really, but
we talked to a retired judge, and I can't remember. Might have been Proudfoot, and she talked about intuition and the importance of intuition.
Yeah.
In reaching decisions about people.
I think that's she's right.
So you get to a point where you can tell, you know human nature well enough to know the rough outlines of a character.
Yeah, you try to, and maybe that's got to do with your upbringing, your background, people that you've met, the activities you've been involved with. I don't know. I hate to say this, but I've probably let go 5 gold medalists at law school from law school. They can tell you all the contract decisions, but they can't put them into effect. They can't deal with people. And, clients saying, what the heck's going on here? This guy's trying to tell me how to run my business or whatever the reason is, So scholarship's good. And Bill O'Leary, our gold medalist, was a terrific lawyer and a terrific judge, but it's not a guarantee that if you stand at the top of your class, you're going to succeed in the profession. The profession's different than the law school. Some people will, Dean Babinski, if you write that and she reads it, she'll be mad at me, but it's true, I think. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was wondering if I could just ask a sort of a follow-up to that. With that idea, with being able to read witnesses on the stand or mm-hmm. other people or have that sort of intuition, did you find over your practice over the years that your intuition became more acute, or that was something that you were prepared with when you came into life?
Mm-hmm. I think you learn as you go. You get better. And the other group you have to learn to deal with if you're a barrister are the judges. Not all judges are the same by any means. Some of them are extremely sensitive. Some of them have lots of humor in them, and it's an interesting study. Just the judges. And I'll tell you, when I first used to go to the Supreme Court of Canada, which is in the 1960s now, God, it's a long time ago, the court was extraordinarily serious. There was no smiling, laughter, humor, nothing. It was very, very, very serious. And then it became a little less serious. And I had an incident in the Supreme Court of Canada involving my dear friend Iacobucci. There are 9 judges up there. He's at this end, and Justice Jack Major's at that end. The case involved a First Nation selling herring spawn on kelp to the Japanese, and they were charged with breaching the Fisheries Act for doing that, so we argued that they had an Aboriginal entitlement to do it. It's called the Gladstone case, if you happen to know that case. It's a very important one, by the way. Anyway, when I stood up and started to argue, Iacobucci said, you know, until I was 18, everyone in the East End of Vancouver thought I was a Japanese soccer player. Iacobucci, you know. I said, I remember that. And so I got arguing, and suddenly Jack Major at the other end of the bench said, do the Japanese eat the herring spawn and the kelp? And I said, you know, I don't know, but just give me a second, Iacobucci. But, you know, you're at a certain age, you can get away with more than you can when you're younger. But, oh, God, they laughed like hell over that. But anyway, you know, if a younger lawyer might have said, oh, Jesus, this is scaring the hell out of me. That's a serious question. But Jack Major didn't give a shit if he ate. He just wanted to have a little bit of fun, you see. But a younger lawyer might have said, oh, God, that scares me. I've got to make a phone call. Do you eat the kelp? But it's very important, I think, to show your sincerity in the court as well. That's very important. You know, you're not there to BS people. You're there because you really believe in the points that you're making right on your feet. That's important. And the judges can pick that up. If to them, they're saying, well, this is just another case to him. She says this all the time. You can't accept that. That's no good. You have to. I had another case Justice John Sapinka. He passed away, unfortunately. He was a very good guy and a very good judge. It was one of the Christian Brothers from Mount Cashel cases. And this, the guy that was charged was from here, actually, Vancouver College. I don't know whether you know that school, but it's a Christian Brothers school, just over the one I went to.
Mm-hmm.
He was charged with abusing children. And he was convicted in Newfoundland, and the judge disbelieved his evidence. The judge believed the evidence of the main complainant, although I caught him lying 11 times on important matters, including lying on Oprah Winfrey, by the way. And so he was convicted. He went to the Court of Appeal in Newfoundland, convicted again 2-1. One judge dissented. So we took it to the Supreme Court of Canada, and I just looked John Sapinka in the eye. I knew he'd be the guy because he was the criminal mind there. And I said, yeah, I just shook my head, John, you just got to do this right. The guy wasn't guilty. He really wasn't guilty. So they overturned the finding of credibility. That's never done. You see, the Court of Appeal doesn't see the witnesses. That job is for the trial judge that sees the witnesses to believe or not believe. And it was such a clear case of a wrongdoing, you know, wrong decision that they, but, you know, John and I knew each other, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but he could trust me that, you know, this guy was not guilty. I had 300 letters of students of support for him, saying this just wouldn't be happening. It wasn't him. And what had happened in Newfoundland is that a lawyer from Toronto is now disbarred. Went back there and told these kids that, you know, there's a lot of money at stake here if you, you know, if you've been wronged. And that might be what happened, I don't know. And the brother of the main complainant testified for the prosecution and said, this didn't happen. This man did not assault my brother. Now, that's a reasonable doubt if there ever was one, you know, but convicted.
And so you had a relationship. You had...
Yeah.
Dealt with Sopinka before,
yeah.
So you could say...
Yeah, and I'd played tennis with him. We weren't close friends, but we knew each other. He trusted me. You know.
And he knew your track record, presumably.
I don't know.
You were...
He might have.
Would he take your reputation into account?
You know, I don't know that. To be honest, I don't know that. But, I mean, I think my relationship with the court was that they would trust me. When I said, you know, this is an exception. I've prosecuted cases and taken them there too, so they knew I wasn't just a defense guy. But it was one of those cases where the court had to do something, even though it wasn't their tradition to do it. In other words, interfere with findings of fact. And it kind of had something to do with the fact that I think John would believe that if I said this is the case, I was telling the truth. You know, I might be wrong, but I think that. And I think Iacobucci was on that bench too, but I'm not positive, but I think he was. That's a very interesting case if you ever do criminal work, because it's very unique. I don't know another case like it where the court has overturned findings of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rule is right, that they shouldn't. But there's the odd one that falls through the cracks, you know, and you don't want an innocent guy to be languishing in jail. That's pretty bad.
You mentioned that in your CV that there were three of the 15 cases in Canadian most cited,
right,
or
yeah, most.
What were they?
About 40 scholars. 40 scholars, Canadian scholars, ranked events in Canada, legal events in importance, including, you know, the charter being created and so on, but also the cases. Dalgamou case, I think, was ranked 15th in importance in the history of Canada. The Guerin case was 10th, and the Sparrow case 4th. They're all First Nations cases. And the Guerin case was the first case I did. That's the case that involves the lands of the Shaughnessy Golf Club that belong to the First Nation, the Musqueam Band.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, others would disagree, I'm sure, but that's an important case because finally a First Nations band won a case. You may not be aware of this, but it's not until 1951 were First Nations entitled to have their own advisors. They mm-hmm. weren't allowed to have, without government permission. So, of course, if they wanted to sue the government would say you can't have advisors. I'm not sure of that, but that might have happened. And the self-image of First Nations was that they can't sue a big brother here. From the cradle to the grave, we've been looked after. That was not true, but that's what the thought was. And so what happened is I met Delbert Guerin, who was the chief of the band, Musqueam Band, in 1979, I think, 1978. And he told me that, I was dealing with him on another matter, he told me that they had this darn case started by a professor at UBC, and all sorts of lawyers across Canada told them to drop the case, they wouldn't win it. First of all, the statute of limitations would defeat them. And secondly, you're alleging that the government of Canada is your trustee, and they're not your trustee. So I looked at the facts, and I said, you know, these facts cry out for justice here. These facts are bad. That land was defrauded from them by the government without any question. Now, the problem was that they sued about 11, let me see. About 9 years after the event, and the statute of limitations is 6 years. So I said, okay, well, one way around that is to allege the government was fraudulent. That'll defeat the statute of limitations. Fraud defeats it. And secondly, I think the government is your trustee. But, you know, everyone disagreed with that. So we went to court on that case, and we showed that the government lied to them, and they got them. You see, in the First Nations world, the First Nations can't sign their own leases if they're for more than 1 year. What they do is surrender the land to the government, then the government becomes the landlord. So they have to have a surrender meeting to vote on whether to do that. So at the surrender meeting that they had on the 6th of October 1957, the government lied to them about the lease. Lied to them.
This was the surrender of the land, that
surrender of the
for
land.
The golf course land.
Yeah, lied to them about what would be in the lease. And then I found out that they signed the lease on the 22nd of January 1958 and wouldn't give the band a copy of the lease until Delbert Garin stole it in 1975 from the Department of Indian Affairs with the consent of the guy running it, by the way. And he was shocked at the contents of it. So there it is, and I gave the, pardon my language, I gave the government a bad time over this, in that case and in another one. The nerve of them alleging that the statute of limitation applies when they wouldn't even give the band a copy of the lease until the expiration of the statute, and then allege that they should have sued earlier. On what? They didn't have the document. They didn't know it was in it. And so then we go to trial here, and at the end of the trial, the government finds a case in England called Tito and Waddell, which is a decision of McGarry J. of England, involving some South Sea Islanders who allege that the government of England breached their trust. So the court held that there was a trust relationship between them and the South Sea Islanders and so on, but it was a political trust, not a legal trust. What's the remedy for a political trust? Don't vote for us. Now, I told you that the surrender was in 1957 in the Garin case. Indians couldn't vote until 61. Now, my point is that the government shouldn't raise things like that. That's not that's an unprincipled thing to do, to say to you, your political beneficiaries, not legal ones, so don't vote for us, when they knew you couldn't vote. That isn't the way to run the country. It's terrible. Awful. And so, if I'm boring you with these stories, let me know.
No, it's very interesting.
We won the case and got $10 million from the trial. The government then appealed. And by the way, at the end of the trial, the government said, we want to amend our pleadings now to allege a political trust. I opposed it. The court said, okay, you can do that. So I said, okay, I want to cross-examine the Minister of Justice and the Prime Minister about this. And the judge said, you could do that. So the government just didn't amend their pleadings. They dropped that defense of political trust. We get to the Court of Appeal. New lawyer for the Crown. Ian Binney. You know that name?
Yeah, I do.
He just retired from the Supreme Court of Canada. We've had lots of interesting things, Ian and I. So we get to the Court of Appeal. Lo and behold, they raise political trust again. So there's three judges there on the Court of Appeal, including Jerry LaDane, who the LaDane Commission on Drugs eventually. I don't know if you knew that, but so I say to them, This is ridiculous. They dropped that defense. The court said, you're right, don't bother arguing that. So we finish your argument. 6 months later, we get the judgment. We lose the case. Political trust. Political trust.
So it was the Court of Appeal that made that decision?
Yeah, having told me not to bother with it. It was the most responsible thing I think I've had in the court. So just my luck in the meantime. So we appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. The new appointee to the Supreme Court is Jerry Ledain, the one who wrote that judgment. So of course he couldn't sit on the case. So only seven judges sat on the Guerin case. So they all agreed that the lease was an outrageous lease, that there was a trust relationship, and that Her Majesty was guilty of fraud. Probably the first time Her Majesty in the history of the British common law was guilty of fraud. I'm not sure of that, but I have a feeling that might be right. She was above it, you see. So that case became pretty important. Then that was ranked 10th. The Sparrow case ranked 4th, took place.
Hi.
Hello. Oh, hi, dear.
Sorry. I'm going to have to ask
Richard
someone
and Graham.
To move.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. No problem.
It's her birthday.
Yeah.
I'm Richard.
How do you do?
Graham.
Hi, Graham. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. If you just want it, you can pull it back.
So that is the Guerin.
That was Guerin, Guerin, yeah.
And you said that Her Majesty was found guilty of fraud. Do you know if that's
called equitable fraud?
Equitable fraud.
Yeah.
Have other instances been found? You know of.
I don't know of any other case where she's been found guilty of that. There might be some. I don't know every case, of course, but I don't know of another one.
So was that the result in the end of the structure of the Department of Indian Affairs? And
I don't know. I think there was. It resulted in a big wake-up call for them. I may be wrong about that. There are better people to talk about that with than me, because people in the department would know, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of another case that had happened of any importance for First Nations before that one. There was a case that Tommy Berger did called the Calder case. Mm-hmm. That would be in the, around 1973, something like that. Mm-hmm. But and that was a case for the Nishkas that resulted in a decision, four judges for them, four against, and one said, you didn't get permission to sue, so therefore you're out of court. You didn't get what's called a fiat. You had to get permission to sue the government at that time from the government. Give me a break. Anyway, so that case didn't result in a decision. It was 4-4-1. So I think the Guerin, arguably at least, is one of the first cases of any importance for First Nations.
And how did you get involved in the first place with Native, with First Nations?
That was, when I was prosecuting, I, I developed a great sympathy for First Nations when I was in the hospital as a kid. The little boy beside me was a First Nations boy from, I think, the Williams Lake area, and he died. And we spent, you know, months together on in beds beside each other.
Yeah.
But then when I was prosecuting, I noticed too many First Nations, A, before the courts, and B, without lawyers. I thought it was not very good. I can tell you a quick joke about one case I had.
Sure.
There used to be a charge of having liquor in a restaurant, and the penalty was a $50 fine or 30 days in jail, but you had to pay the fine right away or do the 30 days. So a rich guy had given him the $50, poor guy goes to jail for 30 days. One day this First Nations guy came up before this judge, the one, by the way, that was with that lady that I mentioned to you.
Right.
And this poor guy came up to him and he said, "Your Worship, I don't know what to do with this. What do you think?" And the judge looked down at him very pompously and said, "It's not my job to think." And I told the judge he was doing a very fine job. Anyway, just after the Guerin case, the Musqueam Band have been fishermen for years, centuries. Mm-hmm. And one day, there was a truck that came down to the reserve. Chilliwack Fish Company written on the door of the truck. And they had all sorts of cash. They would knock on doors and say, "Madam, would you like to sell some fish?" So some old lady down there would sell them two fish for exaggerated amounts of money. And they'd go from door to door. And, well, they were undercover fishery officers. And one morning, about 6 or 7 in the morning, they descended on the band with television cameras blazing. Now, I asked the head of the fisheries department here, how did the TV stations get involved here? "We don't know." And I said, "Oh, I guess they were just driving down the street at the time you were raiding, were they? 6 in the morning?" They obviously notified them. So they charged 25 of them with selling fish not caught with a commercial fishing license and took 10 of their cars away. I'm talking about buying 2 or 3 fish from an 80-year-old woman or something, you know, come on. So we go to court, every one of them was acquitted. Not one was convicted. They couldn't prove how the fish were caught. They had to prove they were not caught with a commercial fishing license. They couldn't prove it. That year, the government said the Musqueam could fish with a net 75 fathoms in length. So when they all got acquitted, the government said, "Okay, we'll teach you. You can only do 25 fathom nets now." So Ronnie Sparrow, a commercial fisherman with a $1 million boat, didn't live at the band. Said,
Was he First Nations?
He was, yeah. He's a member of the band, but didn't live at the reserve.
And he had he was also a commercial fisherman.
Yeah. He went out with a 38 fathom net, and they caught him and charged him. So that became the Sparrow case. And the band was able to prove in that case that they have an Aboriginal entitlement to fish for food and ceremonial purposes. And that's the case that kind of defined Aboriginal rights. And I think that, arguably that is the most important of the First Nations cases. I mean, how do you measure these things? But that's why it was voted that way.
And then these were both, Guerin and Sparrow were both
Musqueam. Yeah. And then I didn't do the trial in the Dalgamuukw case. That was for two First Nations. One of them decided to get new lawyers for the appeal part of it, and so they came to our office. And that case involved an Aboriginal entitlement to huge tracts of land. It was a land case. And the Musqueams intervened in it, so I acted for the Musqueams in that case too. So they were, and as well as one of the bands that were involved. The trial lasted 384 days in that case. That's a very, very long trial. Very long trial, believe me. It cost millions of dollars, I'm sure.
Those weren't consecutive days, were they?
No.
Over years.
Over a period of time, yeah. You could never do it in consecutive days. You know, you work till midnight every night when you're in court. They'd have to have 40 teams of lawyers. That case is important. The problem with that case in part is that it was sent back for a new trial. They set out the principles and then said, now there should be a new trial. And that's a problem because that's very costly, you know. A new trial, my goodness. These are just First Nations. They're not rich people at all. So.
And this was, Alan McEachern was the...
Alan McEachern was the judge at the trial, yes. And a fine man he was, too. And then the Court of Appeal kind of overturned him, and then the Supreme Court of Canada went a bit further.
I've heard his, I think everyone knows it, who does BC history knows his characterization of the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en as their lives is nasty, brutish, and short.
Yeah, that's from another book, you know.
Is it?
And the First Nations did a T-shirt. Who is nasty, brutish, and short? Alan wasn't very tall, but he was a good guy, and he did a lot. He was with Russell Dumoulin, the firm that I mentioned earlier, and. He was a good person.
But do you think that his... You said earlier that you thought it, that he had made the wrong...
Yeah, I think he came to the wrong decision, I think. Yeah. And the court agrees that he did, you know. And he did his best. And the decision is literally a book. He worked very hard. Alan's wife is a judge of our Court of Appeal now, Mary Newberry. Yeah, she's a nice lady. There's a lot of subjectivity in all these cases. Sometimes the trial judge is right and the Supreme Court of Canada wrong. You know, it's not science. It's a lot of judgment involved.
Did you get a name as a native a defender of native interests?
Oh, golly. I imagine so, but, I don't know much about myself. It's funny. I'd mm-hmm. have to ask somebody else that, but I imagine a bit of that, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was your other... What other work? What other...
Let me see. I think I did the first money laundering case in Canada, just after the legislation was changed. I've been involved with other community things, you know. Community. Do you need a CV of all these people who are interviewing?
Well, I have your CV.
Oh, you do? I don't think that's a recent one. I'm not sure.
I think you might have sent that.
I don't know. I can get you a little bit more if you need it. But I'm the chairman of the board of a private hospital, surgical clinic, Cambie Surgery Center. We're before the courts right now. Mm-hmm. Our view is that the Canadian medical system, controlled largely by the provinces, offends the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Mm-hmm. And I'll just explain to you what I mean. And do you know the Chioli case from...
It's not really.
Supreme Court of Canada. We were involved with the Chioli case. It was considered the most important case in Canada a couple of years ago. And here's the situation in Canada. We have a one-payer medical system. No other country in the world that I know of, except maybe North Korea, has a one-payer system. All the others have parallel private systems. That's at least partly unlawful in Canada, and I'll explain what I mean in a minute there. If you hurt your knee, for example, and need a knee operation, in Canada, and certainly BC, you cannot pay for it privately in BC unless you're on workers' compensation, member of the RCMP, the military, or a federal penitentiary inmate. So the three of us would be breaking Section 7 of the Medicare Protection Act if we went to a private clinic and had surgery on our knee or wherever. And you can't get insurance to cover it either in Canada.
But why do private clinics even exist?
Well, because they do a lot of work for workers' compensation. And if you live in Calgary, you can come to Vancouver for surgery lawfully. If you live in Vancouver, you can go to Calgary or Seattle or wherever you want. And a lot of people just go to private clinics and pay. They're not going to wait 2 years for a knee operation and be lame for 2 years.
But it has to be in a different jurisdiction.
Well, it technically, if the BC law is right, it does, but people are ignoring that law because they think the law is wrong. And I think it's wrong, too, because the Charter of Rights and Freedoms will trump a provincial statute if it's in disagreement. And Section 7 of the Charter says that Canadians have a right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Security of the person is offended by the province when they make you wait 2 years for surgery. Furthermore, Section 15 says we're all equal. Well, I'm not as equal as the guy on workers' compensation because he can go to a private clinic lawfully.
Wouldn't it depend on how you define security of the person?
The Supreme Court defined that as being offended when you have to wait too long for surgery.
So that's clear. That's
clear, yeah.
Clear.
And in two decisions they've said that. The politicians, and let me tell you this, the nurses' union is our biggest enemy. They're in court against us.
Because this is threatens their work.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I thought their work was to be in the best interests of patients, but maybe not. I've used this, and I've written a bit about this. I've used this analogy. Let's assume a nurse injures her left knee at work one day while helping with surgery or whatever, and needs surgery on it, and on the way home she injures her right knee out of her work environment. She can get her left knee done next week and her right knee in 2 years. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And in the meantime, people are suffering. We've written about this, but also we've done young athletes, a young striving basketball player, for example, in a high school, on his way to get a good scholarship, hurts his knee. Is he supposed to wait 2 years until he's in second year university to try to get the scholarship, or should he get it done now? In BC? And why can somebody from Calgary come here and get it done, and somebody from Kamloops can't? It's weird. And if they shut down all the private clinics from doing any work, there'll be another 50 or 60,000 on the wait lists in BC for surgery. There's about 80,000 now.
So do you see the solution as a parallel or a dual system?
Yes.
Private and public?
If you hurt your knee in Paris, for example, or in Stockholm, Sweden, a socialist country, you'll get surgery probably in, I don't know, 7 to 10 days, something like that. You hurt your knee here and see how quick you can get it. See how quickly you can get in to see a specialist, never mind the surgery. Our system is broken. We're ranked 27 out of 30th in the OECD countries. We spend We have one civil servant for every 1,600 Canadians in the Medicare world. Germany has one for every 16,000. Hmm. Why?
With our other interviews, we ask people what the greatest change they've seen over their career. And two or three people have mentioned the, I shouldn't give away the answer, but the charter.
Yeah.
Is this an example of that?
Yes, it is, yeah. Charter's made a very big difference. It's made a big difference to the cost of litigation, too. When I was quite young, I'd do a murder case. Maybe 3 days would take. That's unheard of. There'd be no such thing as a three-day murder trial in front of a jury.
Why? I mean, what are the ingredients that have changed?
Well, there's usually a charter argument that goes with every criminal case, I think. But I think we've conditioned ourselves to not have a high enough regard for the essence of time. I think we've got to make things more efficient in the courtroom. And I've spoken to judges about this too at different conferences. Mm-hmm. I think judges have got to learn to set time limits on cross-examination, for example. I've had cases where my co-lawyers or others have cross-examined witnesses 7 to 10 days. One witness, 7 to 10 days. Now that's expensive for one thing, but what witness knows enough to be questioned for 10 days? I mean, get to the point. And what judge can remember everything from one witness in a 10-year period of cross-examination? I don't know. The best cross-examiners I've seen, as I said, are the ones that are the shortest. They know how to do it. And they know how to get it into the mind of the judge that these answers are important and they help me. But if you are all over a witness with a shotgun approach, the judge is there. It's not worth it. I don't know. But others will disagree with me. I'm just giving you my opinions. I'm not trying to write a Bible here.
did you have any desire to be a judge?
I didn't. I don't know why I didn't. It was suggested to me over the years a number of times. But I prefer the hurdy-burdy of the practice and the excitement of litigation from down here, not up there. But, you know, I admire people that want to be judges. It isn't that I think it's a bad thing to do at all. I think it's good. But it's not for everyone.
We've talked to three or four of them in the last few weeks.
Oh, well, have you?
Judges, yeah. But you're the first, and I'm, you know, as a greenhorn, I jotted down some things from your CV. Court work, litigation, senior litigation counsel, trial lawyer, barrister, trying to work out with my Wikipedia approach. But what are some of the qualities that are required in the courtroom? Courtroom.
Let me start by saying this. I've had experiences in three other countries. They're, you know, not lengthy experiences, but I've been through the systems of three other countries. I've had trials in every province of Canada except Prince Edward Island, along with the Northwest Territories. And I think that our profession in British Columbia needs to take a backseat to none of those places that I've seen. I think our standards are high, and I give a lot of credit to the Law Society and the law school for that. But in the courtroom, nothing can beat preparation. What I've tried to do, and I don't know, I've probably not succeeded, but what I've tried to do is make trials I've had look simple, not complex. Because to be honest about it, most of them are simple. are much more simple than people sometimes think. You don't need to reinvent the wheel every time you have a trial. You have to be polite. You have to be firm. And you have to be respectful to the court, the witnesses, and the other lawyers. Now, lawyers have arguments in the courtroom. Some of them get a bit hectic. But just be firm and, you know, if you have a point to make, make it. But don't make it 25 times. Make it once if you can. Those are some of the qualities that I think are required. And generally speaking, those are qualities that you see in the courtrooms of Canada. Mm-hmm. I like our system. Mm-hmm. I like our system.
What about preparation? Research and...
One of the last trials I did was a trial that lasted, I think it's 369 days. It was in Calgary. And in that case, there were, I think, 10 to 20 million pages of documents. An absurd number of documents. Our side put very few of them in. But the thing to do is to be prepared, even though preparation involves all that documentation, to go to the courtroom with just the 10 documents that really matter, or 20 or whatever it is, might even be one, maybe none. But don't inundate the court with 20 million pages of documents. But in order to not do that, you have to work hard in your preparation.
How do you prepare? Do you memorize things? Do you rehearse?
In almost every case I've done in the past 20 years, I've had a very good team with me. Very good team. I've been so lucky. Had some outstanding people working with me. I don't know. Somehow or other, I don't know how to put this, but I've learned to get to the point of a case quickly. Now, maybe I've not always been right about what the point is, but I think that that's something that I learned to do at one point, and I would recommend that to others. Others I've seen don't really know what the main point of the case is. All these peripheral things that don't matter at the end of the day are consuming time and energy, and so.
But wouldn't I don't understand the mechanics of how the court works, but wouldn't the judge ask people to get to the point?
Sometimes they do, but I've learned in the past number of years that the trial judges, once hearing the evidence, have tended, I think, to be concerned about the Court of Appeal. In other words, don't tell that lawyer not to continue cross-examining or talking or whatever. You're detrimentally affecting his client or her client. I don't agree with that. I think I've seen cases where judges say to lawyers, look, you've got 2 more hours here to cross-examine, that's it, you've been on your feet 9 days now. That's enough. As I said, the best cross-examinators I've seen are the ones that ask the fewest questions, not the most. Not the most, but to ask...
Why is that? Because you let the person...
Well,
they
get
rope
to the point quickly, and the judge understands the point more profoundly than having to sort through 20,000 questions to get to the point. He can get to the point playing like that on a transcript. You know, the judge the transcripts of the evidence. Do you want to move on?
Maybe
right?
I will move
on. So, but we have to understand litigation is not science, it's an art form. Mm-hmm. It's an art form, and not everybody's an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are, I know, but not everybody's an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are you still practicing?
I'm doing arbitrations, mediations, and I'm involved in the community, different things in the community. I chair the Justice Institute Gala each year, and the Sports Hall of Fame Gala. I did the 100th anniversary gala of the BC Court of Appeal our 2010 it was. We had over 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. It's quite good. Mm-hmm. But I do it with a lot of help. I mean, it's not just me. Good team. So, I play tennis in slow motion.
You said you had worked in three other countries?
Yeah.
What
China,
were they in?
The United States and England. I've been in the sort of in the involved in cases in their systems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't mean 50 cases. I just mean a couple in each.
Yep.
But it's given me the opportunity to see what goes on in those places.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have to take a back seat to anything. Huh. I think we're good. We have an honorable profession in BC, and we have a good court. And I'm very proud to be part of it.
So you were involved in litigation in China?
Yes, I was, yeah.
What was that?
Two things. I was involved with a case in Hong Kong. It was an estate case. And I've toured China three times. And on the first occasion I was in China in 1978, which is quite a while ago now, I observed a couple of trials. I think they might have been set-up trials, I'm not sure. At that time, China was graduating 200 law students a year. That's not many for a billion people, so you can imagine what kind of a system they had. 78 was only 2 years after the end of the Cultural Revolution, and so I visited prisons there and so on, and it was pretty rough. Pretty rough. I went to the Shanghai prison, and it was not a nice place, built by the British in 1907. And the prisoners were not happy, and there were over 2,000 of them in there. Anyway, so, but you know, just I've had trials in Toronto, Halifax, Newfoundland, Quebec, all the provinces, I guess. And in BC, we do it as well as any of them, and from my experience. I don't think we have to imagine that things are going on in Toronto at a higher level than here. I don't think they are. I have 300 partners in Toronto, all very good, but so are the ones here.
Can I ask you a bit more about law school and where did you live? Did you live on campus?
I lived I lived partly at home. Frank Iacobucci and I would drive to school together many days in the East End. Then I moved into St. Mark's College, UBC, and then to Fort Camp for my last year, I think. I didn't have a car, so, you know, it's kind of rough getting across the city every day, mm-hmm. So.
did you socialize with the other law students? Was it
an active
socialization?
We had a very, very friendly, welcoming class. I don't know how this has all happened, but honestly, you look at the other classes, three out of five get the award from one class? That's incredible. And it's going to be 4 out of 6, I guarantee you. And, you know, three of our classmates get the award for the whole university. And that goes back over 100 years. That's an unusual. And there are others that could have, like David Anderson just got the Order of Canada. Doug Mitchell is getting it, or has got it already, and his wife's getting it now.
So, was that a demographic thing that it was... 1965, was it?
62, we graduated.
62, so you were you were in the right place at the right time?
Just a freaky coincidence, to be honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how all these terrific people got together. We didn't know each other.
Yeah.
Well, Frank and I did, but that's about all. Mm-hmm. And it just happened. Warren Mitchell, another one, I don't know if you know the firm Thorstensons.
Yeah, the tax law.
Canada's leading tax law firm. That's, mm-hmm. They just changed the name of it, but it used to be Thorstensen Mitchell. One of our classmates was one of the founders.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how many Queen's Counsel were appointed from our class, but quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure 14, 15, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is that? I don't want to leave anybody out because they're some wonderful people.
You mentioned earlier, before we had the machine on, you mentioned a crowd at 2nd Street, 2nd and Commercial.
Yeah.
Dave Barrett and... could you...
Bill Essen, Chief Justice Bill mm-hmm. Essen. His son is the lawyer, John, now. And Frank Iacobucci lived there.
And they were all in a one block.
Kind of a one block street there. Quite remarkable, you know, especially from the East End.
Barrett didn't go to law school, though, did he?
He didn't, no. He is, Dave Barrett is a Jewish guy that went to Catholic schools in the States. He went to Seattle University and to St. Louis University. He's a nice person. I didn't know him real well, but I know enough about him. He's a good guy. He's sort of like Mike Harcourt, same spirit. And Bill Essen was a very fine Chief Justice, very respected man.
So, but you regarded yourself—you still regard yourself as an East Ender somehow?
I do. In a way, those are my roots, and I'm a bit ashamed of that. when I was a kid, it really wasn't. The idea in life wasn't to go to university; it was to get a job, a steady job. You see, jobs were more scarce then. If you got a steady job, boy, you just had it made. You'd get a wife and get a house, and you know, pretty standard stuff. But things have changed now there, you know. But, Mayor Sam Sullivan was brought up in my street. You know who I mean? Sam Sullivan?
Mm-hmm.
He was brought up in town. I didn't know him, he's younger. I know him now quite well. He's good. He does a good thing. The public, do you know the public salon that he runs? He has three or four meetings a year at a theater downtown. We have 6 or 7, 8 speakers. It's very well attended. It's worth going to.
Is he the mayor you mentioned who was related to Stephen Owen?
No, that's another one. That's Philip Owen.
Oh, right.
Mayor Philip
Owen. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a nice guy, too.
The only other... Graham, you've probably got more questions, but...
There was just one. Do you know round about when Ozzie Gill started?
To my knowledge, it would be about 1963. I might be out there a bit. I've been involved with sports, the Olympics.
Ah, yes, please.
The Olympics.
Yes, that's all part of the story.
Oh, jeez. When I was young, I was a ranked BC slalom and downhill skier as a junior. I played major men's softball, which at that time was a very high standard, like for the world. It's now higher in other places, but it was very high standard. I was the quarterback on the law school touch football team. what else? I've been a ranked BC and Canadian Masters tennis player, but not number one or anywhere near it, but I have played in numerous tennis tournaments. I was involved with a small group of people in the 90s. We were trying to stimulate the Olympics for Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in favor of trying to persuade the world to give us the Summer Olympics, but I think I was wrong. We are not big enough for that. So ultimately we decided on the Winter Olympics, and that kind of helped get the ball rolling to get the Olympics going here. And then I was a director of the Bid Corporation for the Olympics that ultimately won the bid, and then an Olympic ambassador. Olympic arbitration lawyer, if that became necessary during the Olympics. And I carried the torch at UBC the day before the Olympics. I don't know. Tell me if this is all irrelevant. I don't know what you're interested in. But
what would be the arbitration, the role as
well? If there was a dispute about a medal or something,
oh, okay.
There was a group of us, but we weren't called upon, so we really didn't do anything, but I was one of the listed ones. John Furlong's book. Have you read John or seen his book?
I've seen it around. Yeah.
I mentioned in the book at the tail end of it. What else?
I was going to ask who else we should talk to
in our class.
Well, anyone from UBC Law School.
Well, in
school.
Our class, two good ones would be Chief Justice Finch,
mm-hmm.
very nice man, and also Martin Taylor, who's at Hunter Litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Taylor. Before we leave, I'll give you their phone numbers if you want.
He spoke at the 1962 reunion. Or he said something.
Yeah. Oh, he did. Yeah. So did Finch.
Yeah. Taylor was an Englishman.
He was. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
He and I, and mainly he. I think mainly he, and maybe one or two others, edited four editions of the UBC Law Review when we were there. Martin was so good at it. He did one in the summer as well as each year. You know. He came from the newspaper industry. He was a bit older. He's just a wonderful fellow. I want you guys to be at Finch's retirement party on June the 6th. Are you busy June the 6th, 2013?
Next year, well, I think we can probably.
Don't repeat this. We're going to have maybe a little entertainment. Martin will be. Anyway, I just don't want to omit anybody from my class that you should know about. I probably have already. Oh, jeez.
Well, there's a. I have the list here if you want to.
Yeah, well, sure.
Have a look at that.
I think everybody's in this.
Is Finch still? He's still the Chief Justice?
Yes, he is, yeah, of Court of Appeal.
That's
our highest court, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to retire next year. It's mandatory retirement at 75.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be 75 next year. John Jessamine became, I think, a United Church minister or something, if you want to talk about religion. Jack Lee is a good fellow. He's not well. Do you know the name Bob Lee by any chance? If you go downtown, you'll see the YMCA building on Burrard Street. It's named the Bob Lee YMCA building, and that's Jack's brother. Jack has only one arm.
Hmm.
He's a very lovely guy, but he's quite unwell. I don't think I can't tell you about every one of them. There's not enough time for you, but I think you've got sort of the main ones.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, if we can get...
I hate to leave anybody out. I'll phone you if I think of something. If you want.
Sure.
But if you interviewed Martin and Lance, it might be nice.
Yep.
They'd have some very good memories. There's another fellow, Bruce Fraser, who might consider talking to.
See the poet who's written about the caribou?
He's written books.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see. It probably is. Is that what he says in there?
Well, he submitted, instead of a
yeah.
a biography, he's submitted a poem, and
yeah.
he's there
yeah.
in a,
That's
a
Brucey, yeah.
cowboy hat.
He's yeah. a good guy. His brother's a lawyer, and his father was a judge of the county court. He's a good fellow. He's just had a tough time. He lost his wife recently and one of his children, Jesus. But he'd be worth talking to. I'll give you the phone numbers if you want.
That would be great if we could get some phone numbers, even email would be good.
He's
too.
Getting a legal aid award, by the way.
Hmm?
Martin and I nominated him, and he's going to get the award. And he's very worthy of it. Let me just get you
right. good.
Some phone numbers.
Thank you. Yeah, that's...